the majority of what I'm trying to protect against is not actually the government. It's corporate surveillance. This gets a bit more paranoid, but I do think that people should probably be running VPNs all of the time. If you want real freedom of speech online, then preferably you're going to be anonymous.
Do you have any other specific tips when it comes to traveling abroad?
You know, the problem from the privacy standpoint is that if you're using air travel, you're screwed. And, you know, one thing that I'm particularly worried about is the stuff like the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, real-time facial recognition. I don't really know of any countermeasure to that. You have great power that is bestowed upon you when you're going into self-custody, because the total design space of how you can architect a self-custody wallet is massive. But once again, Bitcoin doesn't care.
Today, we're here in Lugano, Switzerland with the man, the myth, the legend, Jameson Lopp. Thank you very much, Jameson.
Great to be here.
Jameson is an American cyberpunk. He's also a Bitcoin advocate, software engineer, and he's one of the world's leading privacy advocates as well. In 2017, you became the target of a swatting attack, and that kind of kicked off your journey into the privacy world. I've heard you spend thousands of dollars in private investigators to make sure that you were able to basically disappear, and that was kind of an experiment to push the envelope on what it takes in the modern world to achieve privacy. First of all, I want to personally thank you for that. I think it's such a great thing to do for every one of us who takes privacy seriously. And I think, you know, it would be nice to start this conversation talking about what are your best tips for privacy and what did you learn from that experiment?
Yeah, I mean, most of the actual financial cost of my extreme privacy journey was due to legal issues of trying to understand what is possible from a legal standpoint to set up to obfuscate my ownership of any publicly registered property, to obfuscate my actual residential address. And unfortunately, like, a lot of that stuff is very jurisdiction specific. And so while I can talk a lot about, you know, what is available in the American tool set, I really don't know what's available in a lot of other countries. And my understanding is that most other countries do not have the same options for setting up legal entities like corporations and trusts that can give you this additional veil over the, you know, true ownership of various things. But, you know, the short version is, regardless of where you are, you know, privacy is about selectively revealing yourself to the world. So the biggest shift that I had to make was a, like, lifestyle and mindset shift, which was just avoid leaking information whenever possible. And that included, in real life, when I'm, you know, talking to neighbors or people around where I live, or they don't know my real name, they don't know what I actually do, I have a, you know, completely different cover identity and pseudonym for stuff like that. And then, of course, there's all of the digital privacy stuff of just trying to avoid leaking information. And to be blunt, it actually involves lying a lot. And you have to get comfortable with lying a lot. And you also have to understand that most of the time it's legal to lie. You know, unless you're entering into some sort of legal contract, you can usually lie about your name and what you do to any, you know, third party that you're interacting with. And it's, I would say, not immoral if you're doing it to protect yourself and you're not trying to, you know, cover up some criminal or nefarious activities that you're trying to do.
That's super interesting. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that most of these, especially legal tips for privacy are jurisdiction specific. Here at CitizenX, we talk a lot about, you know, different jurisdictions, and there are many options for incorporations like trusts in NIVIS or VVI companies, Cayman Islands, and so on. But not many people are aware that the US is one of the best places for privacy, actually. And you have, you know, many options, for example, limited liability companies in the US that protect your privacy. What are your suggestions for incorporating in the US and protecting your privacy?
Well, I recommend finding a lawyer that deals specifically in this, because they need to know exactly how to set it up and how to file the paperwork. And once again, it's a mindset issue, because I've done this multiple times now, because the first time I did it back in 2018, there were some failures that came up later, and essentially, you know, when you have a privacy leak, it pretty much destroys everything you've set up, so you have to start all over again. And the failures were generally a result of me working with lawyers and bankers who had never done this before, and they have a lot of defaults, and the defaults are to put, you know, your personal information into all of these different systems. And so even though I spent hours talking to them up front and I was like, this is why we're doing this, you need to not leak my information, if you're making them go down a path they've never done before, it's just the likelihood of a mistake happening is much higher. So that's the main thing, is, you know, working with someone who has other privacy oriented clients. And then past that, there are specific states in America that are better than others for incorporating, like New Mexico, Wyoming, Nevada, probably a few others. And that basically comes down to what the legal reporting requirements for, like, the owners and managers of LLC are in those states. But it can get tricky if you're setting up your corporations in those states and then you want to acquire property in different states. So one thing that I've found is that some states don't like it if you try to acquire property with an out-of-state registered entity, and they want you to then re-register the entity in the same state, and then you may not have the same privacy protections. So it can get pretty complicated, and this is why it also just got really expensive.
Right. You mentioned that a big part of protecting your privacy is your lifestyle. You are also a big Bitcoin advocate, but you have mentioned in the past that cash is a big thing when protecting your privacy. Why should people care about using cash, and how does Bitcoin get into all of that? How do you make using Bitcoin more private while also using cash to protect your privacy?
Well, because the majority of, I think, what I'm trying to protect against is not actually the government. It's corporate surveillance. And I am very familiar with the pervasiveness of corporate surveillance because I spent the first decade of my career working for an online marketing company. And so I was a big data engineer, and my job was to write software that ingested these petabytes and petabytes of raw analytics information that the company was collecting as a result of all of the emails and website trackers and other things that the marketing companies who were our clients were deploying through our system. And so, you know, my job was to basically help marketers, you know, better target people to, you know, sell specific things to them. So it was, you know, it was not a malicious thing. This is capitalism. This is the incentives at play, you know, on the internet. Data is a commodity. And so in many cases, you as an internet user are presented with a service for free, but what you're really doing is you're paying them with your data that is then used potentially against you. And the problem there is that your data is often collected and then repackaged and resold to numerous different other entities that may not be quite as careful with it. And so it essentially becomes inevitable that as you share data about yourself, either overtly or unintentionally, that data will eventually get leaked and fall into the wrong hands of people who will be malicious and use it against you.
You have also said that the ability to control your data should be a fundamental human right. I think this ties a lot into that. What are your favorite tools, companies, services that are privacy focused and that really help people control their data? For example, there are some companies that prioritize file over platform, others that focus on end-to-end encryption. And you mentioned that, for example, when setting up your companies, it's really important to also set it up with service providers who share the same ethos of sovereignty in the end. So what are your recommendations or favorite company services tools?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, and it depends on exactly what you're trying to do. I tell most people that the biggest, easiest privacy improvement that you can do is to just install ad blockers in your browser, and it doesn't cost you anything. It takes only a couple of minutes, and that will stop a lot of the corporate surveillance that just sort of happens in the background as you are going about your life and browsing the internet. Beyond that, one service that I like for payments, because cash is not always an option, especially if you're trying to do internet commerce, big fan of privacy.com, and they essentially allow you to create as many throwaway virtual debit cards as you want. And the cool thing with these debit cards is they, as long as you put in the right number, expiration date, and CVC code, you can put in any name and any address that you want, which is very helpful, especially if you're buying digital goods or services where you're not physically having something shipped to you. If you are having something physically shipped to you, then there are services that I recommend that are basically like private mailboxes. And whether that's something like Earth Class Mail, which is one of the bigger ones, or in many cases, you can find smaller local shops that will just let you rent a little box for like $20 or $30 a month. So that once again, you're not putting your actual address out there. This gets a bit more paranoid, but I do think that people should probably be running VPNs all of the time. And going down the VPN rabbit hole is really tricky, because unless you're running your own VPN, which I have written about and is beyond the reach, I think, of most people, then you're, once again, you're trusting a third party and you don't necessarily know what that VPN is doing. So the best that I can really offer on the VPN side is I would recommend using one that doesn't require any personal information to sign up in the first place, because obviously, whatever information you give to the VPN provider, they can then use to basically know who you are. And if they're keeping logs, because you never know if they are, even if they claim they're not, and government comes in and asks them for your information, the only way to ever be sure that your information's not going to get shared is to not give it away in the first place. So, for example, I like Mulvad because you can pay them in Monero or other crypto anonymously, and not give them an email address or anything, and they just give you a code that you can plug in, and it just works and it's fast.
Yeah, they're really cool. You really see that they care about your privacy, because they just give you a code and you really see that they don't store any personal identifiable information. The VPN topic is really cool, because I think we're seeing a lot of trends right now in the world. I read your blog post about Musk buying Twitter, and that you think, correct me if I'm wrong, that maybe it's not so much about freedom of speech, but the really cool thing about Twitter is the global consciousness that it creates. But going down the route of freedom of speech, we have seen in the UK the think before you post trend. And I'm kind of worried about, citizenship-based censorship, where states don't only try to control what is said in their land that can be bypassed by VPNs, but what is said by their citizens. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, if you want real freedom of speech online, then preferably you're going to be anonymous. So, you know, not have your real name, face, location, so on and so forth. Otherwise, if you want freedom of speech without having to worry about being deplatformed, then you're going to have to use a protocol that is censorship resistant. So whether that's something like Nostr or potentially Mastodon, I think Mastodon and Blue Sky are not as censorship resistant as Nostr. I mean, I use all of them just so that I can see how they're developing. But to have like the ultimate level of sovereignty and censorship resistance in these systems, they often require you to be tech savvy and, you know, run your own server so that you can't be deplatformed. Nostr is nice because you don't have to run your own server, because it kind of inverts the model so that you're sending your data to many different servers, and any one of them can block you, of course, but the likelihood that all of them are going to block you is quite low.
Nice. I think going from the topic of, you know, kind of moving yourself in cyberspace with VPNs to moving yourself physically while traveling, you have mentioned some tips for traveling. When you're abroad, you encrypt all your devices and lock them up. Do you have any other specific tips when it comes to traveling abroad?
Mostly around security. So the problem from the privacy standpoint is that if you're using air travel, you're screwed. Like there's no way to have a pseudonym cover identity that is going to get you past border control. Like I said, I'm doing everything legally. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go down the path of like trying to forge a passport and trick the government, anything like that. However, you know, if you're not in a rush, there are usually other means of transportation to travel, which may not be quite as hard on the KYC area. At least in America, and I think when I've used trains in Europe, you know, they don't actually ask you for your ID. They may ask you for your name, but once again, you could lie and you're probably not going to get checked on that. one reason that I really like America is that it's, you know, it's huge. Like, I think it's as large, if not larger, than all of Europe. And you can drive through like 95% of it if you have the time to do so. And of course, there's no real border checkpoints as long as you stay inside of the country. So driving is generally a privacy conscious thing to do. However, you know, there's the tolls. And I have successfully managed to do the toll transponders in a private manner, where once again, I just register them to an LLC, and you know, the actual car that is in is also registered to the LLC. But you know, all of this stuff is like, it works for now, but when I look in the future, I think it's going to get harder and harder, mainly due to the continued pervasiveness of cameras and facial recognition. And you know, one thing that I'm particularly worried about is the stuff like the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. There's already been a proof of concept where some, you know, university graduate hacked real-time facial recognition and identity lookup into the glasses. And so, you know, if that becomes a thing, I don't really know of any countermeasure to that. Like, there are some products out there where you can get like infrared lights, like either in glasses or hoodies or caps or whatever. But I think that those are far from 100% effective, and they're reliant upon the target camera like being in infrared, you know, night mode, or having some other vulnerability where the infrared can essentially override the sensor. So, I mean, all of this stuff it's constantly moving target because technology is constantly evolving. Governments and corporations are constantly seeking to incorporate the latest technology so that they can collect more and more data and use it for whatever their purposes are. And it seems like the defensive side of technological innovation has not been really keeping up.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, especially, you know, when it comes to legal methods of, for example, you know, obscuring your identity or even have alternative identities. Like, not so many people are aware of this, but there are some countries that allow you to legally get a passport under a different name. Like, for example, Vanuatu, Dominica, Turkey with the ethnic script. They allow you to legally change your name. There are also products I have seen, like, for example, the Palau e-residency ID that is, you know, kind of accepted some places. So you could say that, for example, you could use it to check in hotels or maybe, you know, on a train or something that is more low level than air travel. But I think the point of biometrics is such a good point. And not only that, you know, it's happening, but also it's happening on the private sector. It's something that should be probably taken as seriously as, you know, military technology. But, you know, we have seen companies that are, you know, advancing it either through the Meta glasses or for example, WorldCoin with the scanning of the eyeballs. Where do you think the future of biometrics is going? Do you think it's going to be controlled only by governments, or there are going to be private companies setting up checkpoints like Clear in the US?
Well, I mean, I don't think private companies are going to be as in your face about it. You know, governments are already there. You know, when I'm going through border control, a lot of it is automated now, and it's quite convenient. But on the corporate side, I think it's just going to be more that, you know, every corporation with physical presences is going to put cameras everywhere to protect their own property, you know, to be able to do their own forensic analysis of stuff. And even like in the case of retail stores, I think this is already happening in some cases. Basically, you know, if you try to steal from the store, they put you on a blacklist, and then they can basically in real time figure out if you're trying to come back into the store and set off alarms. But you know, this is also going to be used for sort of predictive marketing analytics. They're going to tag you. They're going to watch you as you walk around. They're going to look and analyze what you're looking at and try to figure out, you know, what it is that you're interested in, and then target you in other ways. And that's going to be a very cross-platform thing where, the real, you know, the value add of all of this stuff is that, you know, they've already got a ton of information and analytics that are being collected in cyberspace, and now they want to do the same thing in meat space and then merge them all together so that they can advertise to you in cyberspace based off your meat space activities, and possibly even vice versa. You know, it's not too outrageous to think of a future world where if more of us are using like augmented reality glasses or even contact lenses or whatever, that as we're going through meat space, we're probably going to see, you know, targeted advertisements, you know, within our augmented reality.
Yeah, we both are big fans, I think, of the book The Sovereign Individual. How accurate do you think the predictions are? Do you think the future is going in that direction? Because that future that you mentioned sounded a lot like The Sovereign Individual, where you are, you know, most of your life is in cyberspace. And I think, you know, even nowadays, most of our lives are in cyberspace. But I think, you know, that kind of technology can even push it forward faster.
So for me, it's kind of a question of scale. And when I look at the current state of the world and try to identify, you know, what are sovereign individuals? Well, right now, the most prolific sovereign individuals are actually multinational corporations. Like, and what I mean is the entities that have the power to negotiate with nation states. So the question is, you know, what is required, or how long is it going to take for that threshold to be lowered? I would also argue that, you know, billionaires right now are basically sovereign individuals, but, you know, millionaires, not so much. Will we eventually get there? Maybe. But then on the flip side, we are seeing some nation states realize, I think, that this is starting to happen. And I think I've seen some countries basically proposing to do the same thing that the United States does, as you were kind of mentioning with free speech, but with taxation of like, we're going to tax you regardless of where you are physically, because we realize that you could just leave very easily and not come back and you know, skip out on all of the money that we want to extort from you.
Right. I think that's going to happen. Something that, you know, I hear a lot is that only the US and Eritrea have citizenship-based taxation, and they tax citizens globally no matter where they live. The reality is that there are more countries that already have it, and there are some countries, many countries in Europe, that have some sort of citizenship-based taxation. And I think, you know, as nation states basically become bankrupt, and they realize that most of their high net worth individuals, families, they have already left the country, they cannot keep taxing them. The only tool that they will have to go after these people will be citizenship. And they will basically try to tax them abroad and tax them globally to try to, you know, first tax, then confiscate even. We have been talking a lot about privacy. You have mentioned that, you know, privacy is the other side of the coin for security. I think you probably have lots of great insights when it comes to physical security. A way to think about it, I think it is to, you know, you have security on a country level where you have a really safe country, and that's, you know, what many people that watch us care about. But then you also have, you know, safe cities, like, for example, we're here in Switzerland, that is safe on the country level, on the city level, on the probably private property level. And that's what I want to get into right now. What are your best tips to basically make your private property as safe as possible?
Well, like I said, on the privacy side, preferably not to have your name on the publicly registered property, but you know, I would bet that Switzerland, that's probably difficult to do. A lot of European countries generally require you to publicize all information about corporations and other entities. Though I think Sweden is the worst. I think that they basically require you to like publicly post all of your tax information and income and stuff. And that's why a number of high net worth Bitcoiners have been physically attacked in Sweden. But other than that, you know, it's also interesting because I would say Europe in general defaults to stronger physical security for whatever reason. I'm sure it's historical. Europe has had many wars over many centuries. America, not so much. In America, you know, we build our houses very cheaply, and there's generally not much physical security. You know, someone might get a security system or something, which is usually a joke. But, you know, we don't have, even for example, what I'm looking at the window right now, you know, basically steel shutters across everything that make it very difficult for someone to physically break in. And you know, the construction is going to be like stone and cinder block. And, you know, that's probably, I guess, because you don't have quite as much lumber and timber as we do in America. So it varies. And these are all trade-offs, though, right? Is like the flip side is that in European countries, the firearm ownership is usually much more challenging, if it's even possible at all. You know, Switzerland is, I think, an exception to that. But even then, I'm pretty sure Switzerland requires you to keep everything locked up and out of reach. Whereas in America, we may not have the greatest physical security for our actual property, but we're basically allowed to have loaded guns laying around wherever we want. And, you know, that's part of the freedom and responsibility that comes with some of our constitutional rights. So, these are all trade-offs. When it comes to general safety, obviously you can look at the crime statistics, and generally, if you're living in an area that is economically well off, there's not going to be as much crime. So, unfortunately, a lot of it comes down to your own finances and what you can afford.
I think that's super interesting because of the concept basically of the ascending world and the descending world. And I think, you know, that also goes a lot into Bitcoin economics and how there are some places that are kind of aligned with Bitcoin and the ethos, and they will probably do well in the long run. And there are other places that are inevitably declining. Which places are you bullish on, especially when it comes to Bitcoin?
Ooh, that's tough. I mean, I think an easy one is that El Salvador seems to be on the up and up now. You know, there is some controversy around how they've done that. Obviously, if you throw a lot of people in prison, then those people can't be walking around committing crimes. So it's always this trade-off and debate between safety and freedom, right? In many countries where I think you could argue that they are safer, you can also argue that the individual citizens don't have the same level of freedom. And this, I think, has to be an individual decision. Obviously, I lean more on the side of being less safe but more free to go about and do what I want without having some authority telling me how to live my life.
Nice. In 2018, you co-founded Casa with the goal of taking Bitcoin security mainstream with a new system that allows users to own their own private keys. Do you want to get a bit into how Casa makes holding Bitcoin safer?
So the short version is that, you know, we architect a key infrastructure where the whole goal is to eliminate single points of failure. And really what this means is we understand that people are human. Most people, even hardcore Bitcoiners, are not like highly technical people that spend a lot of time thinking adversarially about their own key management system and everything that could go wrong. So, you know, what we've seen over the years is that it's very easy for someone to, if they're getting into self-custody, put themselves into a situation where there are potential single things that could happen that could result in catastrophic loss. So the way that we accomplish this is we have a very simple mobile app where you follow the instructions in the mobile app. And when you get to the end of your setup, you have, think of it as a vault that is distributed where there are multiple keys, either like three keys or five keys. And these keys are distributed across different types of hardware, software, different manufacturers. And then Casa will hold one key as an emergency recovery mechanism. But the whole idea is that if something goes wrong with one of your keys, it's not a problem. Whether if it gets lost, stolen, destroyed, whatever, you still have enough redundancy and resiliency that you can use the other keys to still move your money and basically swap out the compromised key, replace it with a new key, and continue forward. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about managing your Bitcoin, where instead of, you know, having all of your eggs in one basket, in the sense of like all of your money in one seed phrase, your one Trezor or ledger or whatever, because there are things that could go wrong with that, you instead distribute them, you know, geographically, cryptographically, and across many different companies that are writing different software and hardware to prevent things like supply chain attacks. So it's a really complicated series of, you know, thought experiments and potential loss and threat vectors that we have thought through over the years, and we have them all published on our website of like, this is why we do it this way. But the idea is that you follow the instructions, you follow our guidance, and you basically end up in as bulletproof of a self-custody setup as I think it's possible to do these days.
That's fascinating, especially the part about single points of failure. I personally spend a lot of time thinking about single points of failure. I think one of the biggest ones that people fall into is just having one passport and one citizenship. But going more into the self-custody thing, Michael Saylor recently said that self-custody is for paranoid crypto anarchists that worry about the government seizing your Bitcoin, to which you replied that most 6102 gold seizures occurred at financial institutions that held gold on behalf of clients. For example, Frederick Barber Campbell tried to withdraw 5,000 ounces from Chase Bank. They reported him and the gold was confiscated. Those who kept gold in self-custody were safe.
Yeah, but you know, it's not just about that, right? Because if you only talk about government seizure risk, then I think the average person will consider you to be a paranoid person, because government seizure happens so rarely, and so it's not a threat that they consider to be a high risk. But you know, what I would say is that if we look across the past decade of history in this space, leaving your money with a trusted third party is high risk. A large percentage of trusted third parties have failed over the years. And maybe it's because they're malicious and they stole people's money. Maybe it's because they're incompetent and they got hacked. In some cases, they were incompetent and they literally lost their own keys and locked themselves out of it. So the best way that I've been able to describe at a very, very high level, like the difference between all of the risks of self-custody versus the risk of trusted third-party custody, is that self-custody is essentially a subset of the risks of trusted third-party custody. Because if you think about it, when you leave your money with a custodian, they are doing self-custody. So they are exposed to all of the risks of self-custody. And I think the average person may say, well, yeah, and that's fine because they're professionals, right? They know what they're doing. They think about this all of the time. And that is true to an extent. But in addition to all of the self-custody risks, you have this extra layer of risks of things like insider attacks. You don't know what that custodian is doing from a security perspective. Like, none of these custodians publish their internal security protocols. This is why they're trusted. You also have to, like I said, worry about incompetency. They might screw up. And then once again, you do have to worry more about government seizure risk, because what's happening, and this is true for both government attacks and just any other type of hacker or attacker, is that you are creating a massive honeypot, because you have thousands, if not millions, of people putting their money in one place that's creating a really high value, juicy target, which is incentivizing attackers to potentially spend a huge amount of resources trying to crack into it, because the bounty, for something like Coinbase is what, millions of Bitcoin? I don't even know how many, like tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars that is at the moment. So it's risky not only for you as an individual, it also, when we're talking about custodians that are getting to that size, it becomes a systemic risk to the entire ecosystem. For example, one of the things I'm really worried about is the fact that something like 90% of the Bitcoin ETFs all keep their money at Coinbase. And now I'm starting to sort of raise the alarm of, if we sort of look out long-term, multi-decade, and we try to assume what a future of mass adoption is going to look like. Well, if mass adoption mostly happens through these ETF products, how much Bitcoin is going to end up in the hands of, you know, 5 or 10 entities? That is very risky from a number of different perspectives that I just explained.
I'm also a big fan of thinking long-term, and one of my favorite features of Casa is that it really shows that Bitcoin is a generational asset, allowing you to set up your Bitcoin inheritance plan. What are your best tips? What is the best way to set up your Bitcoin inheritance plan?
Yeah, so similar to just all of the issues related to setting up your own self-custody wallet, is that it's a tricky thing that is fraught with peril, because you have great power that is bestowed upon you when you're going into self-custody, because you get to decide many different parameters of how you're doing it. And so from that perspective, there's like a decision tree. There's many different decisions that need to be made, and the total design space of how you can architect a self-custody wallet is massive, and not all of those potential paths are safe. So it's easy, if you're not an expert and you don't think about this all the time, it's easy to make some decisions that end up actually weakening your setup rather than strengthening it. And then that becomes doubly true if you're going down the path of inheritance, because when you are setting up self-custody, what you're trying to do is set up an architecture so that no one other than you can access and spend your Bitcoin. When you want to take that next step into making your setup inheritance friendly, now you're walking this really weird tightrope where you want it so that only you can access your Bitcoin while you're alive. But when you die, you magically want the security architecture to change so that someone or some designated set of beneficiaries can access it. And so assuming that you don't want your beneficiaries to be able to access your money while you're still alive, this gets tricky. But the really cool thing about multi-sig is that it, once again, that expands the design space of how we can set up your architecture. And essentially, key sharing is what it comes down to. Like, that's the path that we went down, though it wasn't the first path that we went down. Actually, we had an inheritance product for a couple of years that was more legal inheritance based. And with that, we were onboarding like your family attorney or your executor or, you know, someone to share keys with. And we found that it didn't scale very well. And so the inheritance solution that we just rolled out, I would say 4 or 5 months ago, has no legal requirements to it. So like, you can be in any jurisdiction and it works the same because it's just essentially a software solution. And basically what you do is you onboard your beneficiary by sharing an encrypted version of one of your keys with them. And what the Casa app does is we create our own set of game theory around this. So essentially, you onboard your beneficiary, you share an encrypted key with them. They can't do anything with it because it's encrypted. And if you die, your beneficiary is able to go in the app and basically tap on a button that says, I want to request kicking off the inheritance process. When they do that, we start emailing you and contacting you and saying, hey, your beneficiary said you died. If you're still alive, you know, click this button or call us on the phone or, you know, contact us somehow so that we can kick your beneficiary out because they may be malicious. And basically, we keep trying to contact you for 6 months. And if that time period goes by and you have not contested or disputed the inheritance kickoff, then we allow the beneficiary to decrypt and use that key to initiate a transaction. But once again, they only have one key. So they then have to request from us to co-sign the transaction. And then once we'll finally co-sign a transaction after another waiting period, then, you know, the money can move however they wish.
I love the part that right now it doesn't require any legal setup. It's literally the network over the state, right? It wins every single day.
Yeah, inheritance is really tricky because I think most people are used to legal inheritance. And, you know, if you have a brokerage account or other traditional financial accounts, you may, for example, have beneficiaries listed on them. And it's actually, I've learned a lot about legal inheritance over the past few years as a result of researching and building all of this stuff. And discovered that there's a lot of foot guns in legal inheritance as well. For example, it could actually be a bad idea to list specific beneficiaries on traditional financial accounts. And the reason for that is that tends to override, at least in America, it overrides the sort of default of your local jurisdiction of how inheritance plays out. And it can also even override anything that you specified in your last will and testament. And people may be thinking, well, who cares? Well, the real problem that tends to happen with this is that people tend to set up their inheritance plan and then, of course, not die for many decades and never go back and look at their inheritance configuration for that entire period of time. And so what often happens is that the values of your different accounts may wildly change and no longer be in balance over time. And you might accidentally end up giving, 70% of your net worth to one beneficiary and then the other one loses out. And legally, there's nothing that can be done unless, of course, they all agree to redistribute it themselves. So basically, it's a game theory problem that becomes additionally complicated because people tend not to maintain it over time.
I tend to think that, most taxation is theft, but definitely the one I think it's the biggest theft of them all is inheritance taxes, because, you just have a massive loss and then here comes the state and asks for some, tax. Where's Bitcoin when it comes to inheritance tax?
Well, as far as I'm aware, at least in America, it's treated like any other asset. I'm not aware of any countries that have, specific exemptions for Bitcoin inheritance stuff. But once again, Bitcoin doesn't care. So obviously, it's up to you and your beneficiaries to manage that. Well, it's the executor of your estate is the one who's going to be in charge of making sure that all taxes and creditors of the estate are paid off before the remaining assets are distributed to the beneficiaries. And that's actually another thing that I learned about inheritance, at least in America. A lot of people think that being an executor of an estate is like a great honor. It's actually a huge liability. Like if you screw something up, you can be personally liable for the financial consequences of screwing that up.
Wow. To wrap up this conversation, this is a question that I've seen going kind of viral in different places. Up to you if you want to get into more or less detail, but when you pass away, how do you plan to leave your Bitcoin to your heirs?
Through a carefully constructed inheritance plan, I haven't thought about it too much because I think I've still got a ways to go, and we won't go down this rabbit hole, but I'm also big into like longevity and biohacking stuff, and so I'm optimistic that, if I can take care of myself for a few more decades, then, medical science will continue to progress that, hopefully we'll be able to live well past 100, maybe even 150, if we were able to essentially regenerate ourselves at cellular level. So, this actually does potentially bring up a very different issue, which I have published an article about, which is, and this is because I haven't entirely decided personally on how I'm going to do this, but are you familiar with cryonics?
Yeah.
Right. So, like I said, I'm a transhumanist. I'm interested in life extension. I'm interested in cryonics. I'm not a subscriber yet of any of those services because they do have issues. A lot of them go bankrupt and the bodies thaw and don't get preserved. But I have spent a fair amount of time thinking about and published some thoughts on taking your Bitcoin with you. And by which I mean the security ramifications of how would you secure Bitcoin if you were cryogenically preserved and doing that under the hope that, you may be thawed out in hundreds or even thousands of years, depending, of course, on how long it takes the technology. And this essentially gets you into even crazier, extreme edge case game theory than the inheritance stuff. Because if you think about it, your body basically goes into a trusted third party custodian. So, you know, I've talked to a number of people about this, and the most common thing people say is, oh, I'll just memorize my seed phrase. And I'm like, no, you have to assume that the company that thaws you out can scan your brain and extract all of the information from it. So that's not going to work. And then there's all these other issues around, you know, how technology and you know, potentially have key failure or key rot over centuries or millennia. How do you do that in a way that you can feel comfortable about? And I actually suspect that the answer is going to come down to family and actually instilling values within your family to create a sort of trust chain of generations. And what I mean by this, and there's actually this concept in the cryogenics community. What did they call it? I think they call it the domino of love or something, and I might be butchering that. But the idea is that you get frozen. You know, what is the incentive for anybody to thaw you out, especially 1,000 years in the future, where you probably have no marketable skill set, you have no real use to society other than as a historical artifact. So this is another game theory issue. So the domino of love theory is, you know, you have children, you instill in them the values that you have and do the best you can to make sure that they love you and they want you to be around. And then hopefully they do the same with their children. They do the same with their children. And so if that chain remains unbroken, then at some arbitrary point in the future, the technology will improve enough that we can start to thaw people out. But the thing is, it's going to go in reverse order, because the earlier you get cryogenically preserved, the more damage there will be to your body. And therefore, the greater the level of technology will be required in order to revive you. So it's actually, you're not going to be revived first. It's your great, 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 great grandchildren will be revived first. Well, why are they going to get revived? Well, it's because their children are still alive and they're like, hey, I want to bring my parents back. Mm-hmm. And so then once they're back and the technology progresses, then hopefully they say, oh, I want to bring my parents back. And then that chain goes all the way back, hopefully, you know, optimistically, so that eventually your children get thawed out and the technology progresses and they thaw you out. But yeah, this is some like crazy theoretical edge case stuff that's, you know, sci-fi, but also somewhat realistic game theory, and trying to figure out how would you ever even deal with these type of issues. But that's the type of stuff I find interesting.
That's great. I really enjoyed talking. Thank you very much, Jameson.
Thanks for having me.